"Just excuse me for a while. Don't you think we'd better hurry and leave?" Cobbett asked him, "before people miss her and ask questions?"
"Not at all," said Percivant, his voice strong again. "If we're gone, they'll ask questions about us, too. Possibly embarrassing questions. No, we'll stay. We'll eat a good breakfast, or at least pretend to eat it, and we'll be as surprised as the rest of them about the disappearance of their leading lady."
"I'll do my best," vowed Laurel.
"I know you will, my child," said Percivant, and went out the door.
Dracula's Chair by Peter Tremaine. Peter Beresford Ellis, born in 1943, was born in Coventry, Warwickshire, England, the son of a Cork-born journalist whose family can be traced back in the area to 1288. Ellis, most of whose fiction has been published under the Peter Tremaine pseudonym, earned his B.A. and master's degrees in Celtic studies, then followed in his father's footsteps to become a journalist. His first book, published in 1968, was a history of the Welsh struggle for independence, followed by popular titles in Celtic studies. He has served as international chairman of the Celtic League, 1988 to 1990, and is the honorary life president of the 1820 Society and an honorary life member of the Irish Literary Society. He has produced 88 full-length books, a similar number of short stories, and numerous scholarly pamphlets. As Tremaine, he has written 18 worldwide best-selling novels about the 7th-century Irish nun detective, Sister Fidelma, with more than 3 million copies in print. As Peter MacAllan, he produced 8 thrillers, 1983 to 1993. In the horror field, he has written more than 24 novels, mostly inspired by Celtic myths and legends, including Dracula Unborn, 1977, The Revenge of Dracula, 1978, and Dracula, My Love, 1980. Dracula's Chair was planned as an epilogue to his novel The Revenge of Dracula, but the author decided it was overkill. It was first published in the Count Dracula Fan Club Book of Vampires, 1980.
Dracula's Chair by Peter Tremaine, read by Steve West. Maybe this is an hallucination. Perhaps I am mad. How else can this be explained? I sit here alone and helpless, so utterly alone. Alone in an age which is not mine, in a body which is not mine. Oh God, I am slowly being killed, or worse. Yet what is worse than death? That terrifying limbo that is the borderland of hell, that state that is neither the restful sleep of death nor the perplexities of life, but is the nightmare of undeath. He is draining me of life, and yet is it me who is the victim? How can I tell him that the person he thinks I am, the person whose body my mind inhabits, is no longer in that body? How can I tell him that I am in the body of his victim? I, a person from another time, another age, another place. God, help me. He is draining me of life, and I cannot prevent him. When did this nightmare begin? An age away. I suppose it began when my wife and I saw the chair. We were driving back to London one hot July Sunday afternoon, having been picnicking in Essex. We were returning about mid-afternoon down the A11 through the village of Newport, when my wife suddenly called upon me to pull over and stop. "I've just seen the most exquisite chair in the window of an antique shop." I was somewhat annoyed because I wanted to get home early that evening to see a vintage Humphrey Bogart film on the television, one I'd never seen before, even though I have been a Bogart fan for years. "What's the point?" I muttered grumpily, getting out of the car and trailing after her. "The shop's shut anyway." But the shop wasn't shut. Passing trade on a Sunday from Londoners was apparently very lucrative, and most antique shops in the area opened during the afternoons. The chair stood like a lone sentinel in the window. It was square in shape, a wooden, straight-backed chair with sturdy arms. It was of a plain and simple design, dark oak wood, yet with none of the ornate woodwork that is commonly associated with such items. The seat was upholstered in a faded tapestry work which was obviously the original. It was a very unattractive upholstery, for it was in a faded black with a number of once white exotic dragon's heads. The same upholstery was reflected in a piece which provided a narrow backrest, a strip a foot deep, thrust across the middle of the frame. My impression of the chair was hardly exquisite. It was a squat, ugly, and aggressive piece. Certainly it did not seem worth the £100 price ticket which was attached by string to one arm. My wife had contrary ideas. It was, she felt, exactly the right piece to fill a corner in my study and provide a spare chair for extra guests. It could, she assured me, easily be reupholstered to fit in with our general color scheme of greens and golds. What was wanted, she said, was a functional chair, and this was it. She was adamant, and so I resigned myself to a minimum of grumbling, one eye on my watch to ensure I would not miss the Bogart film. The transaction was concluded fairly quickly by comparison with my wife's usual standard of detailed questioning and examination. Perhaps the vendor was rather more loquacious than the average antique dealer. "It's a very nice chair," said the dealer with summoned enthusiasm. "It's a Victorian piece of Eastern European origin. Look, on the back you can actually see a date of manufacture and the place of origin." He pointed to the back of the chair where, carved into the wood with small letters, was the word B Streets and the date 1887. The dealer smiled in the surety of knowledge. "That makes it Romanian in origin. Actually, I purchased the piece from the old Purfleet Art Gallery." "The Purfleet Art Gallery," said I, thinking it time to make some contribution to the conversation. "Isn't that the old gallery and museum over which there were some protests a few months ago?" "Yes, you know the place. Purfleet in Essex. The gallery was housed in an ancient building, a manor house called Carfax, which was said to date back to medieval times. The old gallery had been there since the late Victorian period, but had to close through lack of government subsidies, and the building is being carved up into apartments." I nodded, feeling I had, perhaps, made too much of a contribution. The antique dealer went on obliviously. "When the gallery closed, a lot of its objets d'art were auctioned, and I bought this chair. According to the auctioner's catalogue, it had been in the old house when the gallery first opened, and had belonged to the previous owner. He was said to have been a foreign nobleman. Probably a Romanian by the workmanship of the chair." Finally, having had her fears assuaged over matters of woodworm, methods of upholstery, and the like, the purchase was concluded by my wife. The chair was strapped to the roof rack of my car, and we headed homewards. The next day was Monday. My wife, who is in research, had gone to her office while I spent the morning in my study, doodling on pieces of paper and vainly waiting for a new plot to mature for the television soap opera that I was scripting at the time. At midday, my wife telephoned to remind me to check around for some price quotations for reupholstering our purchase. I had forgotten all about the chair, still strapped to the roof rack of my car. Feeling a little guilty, I went down to the garage and untied it, carrying it up to my study and placing it in the allotted corner with a critical eye. I confess, I did not like the thing. It was so square and seemed to somehow challenge me. It is hard to define what I mean, but you have, I suppose, seen certain types of people with thrust-out jaws, square and aggressive. Well, the chair gave the same impression. After a while, perhaps in response to its challenge, I decided to sit down in the chair. And as I sat, a sudden coldness spread up my spine, and a weird feeling of unease came over me. So strong was it that I immediately jumped up. I stood there looking down at the chair and feeling a trifle self-conscious. I laughed nervously. Ridiculous! What would my friend Philip, who was a psychiatrist, say to such behavior? I did not like the chair, but there was no need to create physical illusions around my distaste. I sat down again and, as expected, the cold feelings of unease were gone, a mere shadow in my mind. In fact, I was surprised at the comfort of the chair. I sat well back, arms and hands resting on the wooden armrests, head leaning against the back, legs spread out. It was extremely comfortable. So comfortable was it that a feeling of deep relaxation came over me, and with the relaxation came the desire to have a catnap. I must confess, I tend to enjoy a 10-minute nap just after lunch. It relaxes me and stimulates the mind. I sat back, closed my drooping eyelids, and gently let myself drift, drift. It was dark when I awoke. For an instant, I struggled with the remnants of my dreams. Then my mind cleared and I looked about me. My first thought was the question, how long had I slept? I could see the dark hue of early evening through the tall windows. Then I started, for there were no tall windows in my study, nor anywhere in our house. Blinking my eyes rapidly to focus them in the darkened room, I abruptly perceived that I was not in my study, nor was I in any room that I had ever seen before. I tried to rise in my surprise and found that I could not move. Some sluggish feeling in my body prevented me from coordinating my limbs. My mind had clarity and will, but below my neck my whole body seemed numb. And so I just sat there, staring wildly at the unfamiliar room in a cold sweat of fear and panic. I tried to blink away the nightmare, tried to rationalize. I could move my head around, and doing so I found that I was sitting in the same chair, that accursed chair. Yet it seemed strangely newer than I remembered it. I thought perhaps it was a trick of the light, but I discovered that around my legs was tucked a woolen blanket, while the top half of me was clad in a pajama jacket over which was a velvet smoking jacket, a garment that I knew I had never owned. My eyes wandered around the room from object to unfamiliar object, each unfamiliar item causing the terror to mount in my veins, now surging with adrenaline. I was in a lounge, filled with some fine pieces of Victoriana. The chair in which I sat now stood before an open hearth, in which a few coals faintly glimmered. In one corner stood a lean, tall grandfather clock, whose steady tick-tock added to the oppressiveness of the scene. There was, so far as I could see, nothing modern in the room at all. But for me, the greatest horror was the strange paralysis which kept me anchored in that chair. I tried to move until the sweat poured from my face with the effort. I even tried to shout, opening my mouth wide to emit strange choking-like noises. What in God's name had happened to me? Suddenly, a door opened. Into the room came a young girl of about 17, holding aloft one of those old brass oil lamps, the sort you see converted into electric lamps these days by trendy people. Yet this was no converted lamp, but a lamp from which a flame spluttered and emitted the odor of burning paraffin. And the girl. She wore a long black dress with a high button collar, with a white linen apron over it. Her fair hair was tucked inside a small white cap, set at a jaunty angle on her head. In fact, she looked like a serving maid straight out of those Victorian drama serials we get so often on the television these days. She came forward and placed the lamp on a table near me, and then started, seeing my eyes wide open and upon her. I tried to speak to her, to demand, to exhort some explanation, to ask what the meaning of this trickery was. But only a strangled gasp came from my throat. The girl was clearly frightened and bobbed what was supposed to be a curtsy in my direction before turning to the door. "Mum! Mum!" Her strong Cockney accent made the word sound like mum. "Master's awake, mum! What'll I do?" Another figure moved into the room, tall, graceful, wearing an elegant Victorian dress hung low at the shoulders and leaving very little of her bust to the imagination. A black ribbon with a cameo was fastened to her pale throat. Her raven black hair was done up in a bun at the back of her head. Her face was small, heart-shaped, and pretty. The lips were naturally red, though a trifle sullen for her features. The eyes were deep green and seemed a little sad. She came towards me, bent over me, and gave me a wan smile. There was a strange, almost unnatural pallor to her complexion. "That's all, Fanny," she said. "I'll see to him now."
"Yes, ma'am."
The girl bobbed another curtsy and was gone through the door.
"Poor Upton,"
whispered the woman before me. Poor Upton. I wish I knew whether you hurt at all. No one seems to know from what strange malady you suffer. She stood back and sighed sorrowfully and deeply. It's time for your medication. She picked up a bottle and a spoon, pouring a bitter-smelling amber liquid which she forced down my throat. I felt a numbing bitterness searing down my gullet. Poor Upton, she sighed again. It's bitter, I know, but the doctor says it will take away any pain. I tried to speak, tried to tell her I was not Upton, that I did not want her medicine, that I wanted this play-acting to cease. I succeeded only in gnashing my teeth and making inarticulate cries like some wild beast at bay. The woman took a step backwards, her eyes widening in fright. Then she seemed to regain her composure. Come, Upton, she chided. This won't do at all. Try to relax. The girl, Fanny, reappeared.
Dr. Seward is here, Mum.
A stocky man in a brown tweed suit, looking like some character out of a Dickens novel, stepped into the room and bowed over the woman's proffered hand.
John, smiled the woman. I'm so glad you've come. How are you, Clara? Smiled the man. You look a trifle weary and a little pale. I'm all right, John, but I worry about Upton.
The man turned to me.
Yes, how is the patient? I swear he looks a little more alert today.
The woman, Clara, spread her hands and shrugged.
To me he seems little better, John. Even when he seems more alert physically, he can only growl like a beast. I try my best, but I fear that...
The man called John patted her hand and gestured her to silence. Then he came and bent over me with a friendly smile.
Strange, he murmured. Indeed, a strange affliction. And yet I do detect a more intelligent gleam in the eyes today. Hello, old friend, you know me. It's John. John Seward. Do you recognize me?
He leaned close to my face, so close I could smell the scent of oranges on his breath. I struggled to break the paralysis which gripped me, and only succeeded in issuing a number of snarls and grunts. The man drew back.
Upon my word, Clara, has he been violent at all?
Not really, John. He does excite himself so with visitors, but perhaps it is his way of trying to communicate with us. The man grunted and nodded.
Well, the only remedy for pain is to keep dosing him with the laudanum, as I prescribed it. I think he is a little better. However, I shall call again tomorrow to see if there is a significant improvement. If not, I will ask your permission to consult a specialist, perhaps a doctor from Harley Street. There are a number of factors that still puzzle me. The anemia, the apparent lack of red blood corpuscles or hemoglobin, his paleness and languor, and these strange wounds on his neck do not seem to be healing at all.
The woman bit her lip and lowered her voice.
You may be frank with me, John. You have known Upton and me for some years now. I'm resigned to the fact that there can only be a worsening of his condition. I do fear for his life.
The man glanced at me nervously.
Should you talk like this in front of him?
The woman sighed.
He cannot understand, of that I'm sure. Poor Upton. Just to think that a few short days ago he was so full of life, so active, and now this strange disease has cut him down.
The man nodded.
You've been a veritable goddess, Clara, Charity herself, nursing him constantly day and night. I shall look in again tomorrow, but if there is no improvement, I shall seek permission to call in a specialist.
Clara lowered her head as if in resignation. The man turned to me and forced a smile.
So long, old fellow.
I tried to call, desperately tried to plead for help. Then he was gone. The minutes dragged into hours as the woman, Clara, who was supposed to be my wife, sat gazing into the fire, while I sat pinioned in my accursed chair opposite to her. How long we sat thus I do not truly know. From time to time I felt her gaze, sad and thoughtful, upon me. Then I became aware, somewhere in the house, of a clock commencing to strike. A few seconds later it was followed by the resonant and hollow sounds of the grandfather clock. Without raising my head, I counted slowly to 12, midnight.
The woman, Clara, abruptly sprang from her chair and stood upright before the fire. As I looked up, she seemed to change slightly. It is hard to explain. Her face seemed to grow coarser, more bloated. Her tongue, a red, glistening object, darted nervously over her lips, making them moist and of a deeper red than before, contrasting starkly to the sharp whiteness of her teeth. A strange luster began to sparkle in her eyes. She raised a languid hand and began to massage her neck slowly, sensually. Then, abruptly, she laughed, a low, voluptuous chuckle that made the hairs on my neck bristle. She gazed down at me with a wanton expression, a lascivious smile. "Poor Upton." Her tone was a gloating caress. "He'll be coming soon. You'll like that, won't you? Yet why he takes you first, I cannot understand. Why you? Am I not full of the warmth of life? Does not warm, rich, young blood flow in my veins? Why you?" She made an obscene, seductive gesture with her body. The way she crooned, the saliva trickling from a corner of those red, oh, so red lips, made my heart beat faster, yet at the same time, the blood seemed to deny its very warmth and pump like some ice-cold liquid in my veins. What new nightmare was this? How he appeared, I do not know. One minute there was just the woman and myself in the room, then he was standing there. A tall man, apparently elderly, although his pale face held no aging of the skin. Only the long white moustache, which drooped over his otherwise clean-shaven face, gave the impression of age. His face was strong, extremely strong, aquiline with a high-bridged nose and peculiarly arched nostrils. His forehead was loftily domed, and hair grew scantily round the temples, but profusely elsewhere. The eyebrows were massive and nearly met across the bridge of the nose. It was his mouth which captured my attention. A mouth set in the long, pale face, fixed and cruel-looking, with teeth that protruded over the remarkably ruddy lips whose redness had the effect of highlighting his white skin and giving the impression of an extraordinary pallor. And where the teeth protruded over the lips, they were white and sharp. His eyes seemed a ghastly red in the glow of the flickering fire. The woman, Clara, took a step toward him, hands out as if imploring, a glad cry on her red, wanton lips, her breasts heaving as if with some wild ecstasy. "My lord," she cried, "you have come." The tall man ignored her. His red eyes were upon mine, seeming to devour me. The woman raised a hand to massage her throat. "Lord, take me first. Take me now." The tall man took a stride towards me, drawing back an arm and pushing her roughly aside. "It is he that I shall take first," he said sibilantly, with a strange accent to his English. "You shall wait your turn, which shall be in a little while." The woman made to protest, but he stopped her with an upraised hand. "Dare you question me?" he said mildly. "Have no fear. You shall be my bountiful winepress in a while, but first I shall slake my thirst with him." He towered over me as I remained helpless in that chair, that accursed chair. A smile edged his face. "Is it not just," whispered the tall man, "is it not just that having thwarted me, you, Upton Welsford, now become everything that you abhorred and feared?" And while part of my mind was witnessing this obscene hallucination, another part of it began to experience a strange excitement, almost a sexual excitement, as the man lowered his face to mine. Closer came those awful red eyes to gaze deep into my soul. His mouth was open slightly. I could smell a vile reek of corruption. There was a deliberate voluptuousness about his movements that was both thrilling and appalling. He licked his lips like some animal, the scarlet tongue flickering over the white, sharp teeth. Lower came his head, lower, until it passed from my sight, and I could hear the churning sound of his tongue against his teeth and could feel his hot breath on my neck. The skin of my throat began to tingle. Then I felt the soft, shivering touch of his cold lips on my throat, the hard indent of two sharp white teeth. For a while, how long I could not measure, I seemed to fall into a languorous ecstasy. Then he was standing above me, smiling down sardonically, a trickle of blood on his chin. My blood?
"There is one more night to feast with him," he said softly. "One night more, and then up to Wellsford. You shall be my brother."
The woman exclaimed in anger, "But you promised! You promised! When am I to be called?" The tall man turned and laughed.
I promised. My slender vine, you already bear my mark. You belong to me. You shall be one with me, never fear. Immortality will soon be yours, and we shall share in the drinking. You will provide me with the wine of life. Have patience, for the greatest wines are long in the savoring. I shall return."
Then, to my horror, the man was gone. Simply gone, as if he had dissolved into elemental dust. For some time I sat in horror, staring at the woman who seemed to have retreated into a strange trance. Then the grandfather clock began to chime and the woman started, as if waking from a deep sleep. She stared in amazement at the clock, and then towards the window where the faint light of early dawn was beginning to show.
"Good Lord, Upton," she exclaimed. "We seem to have been up all night. I must have fallen asleep. I'm sorry."
She shook herself.
"I've had a strange dream. Oh, well, no matter. I'd better get you to bed. I'll go and wake poor Fanny to help me."
She smiled softly at me as she left the room. There was no trace of the wanton seductress left on her delicate features. She left me sitting alone, alone in my prison of a chair. I sit here alone and helpless. So utterly alone. Alone in an age which is not mine, in a body which is not mine. Oh, God, I am slowly being killed, or worse. Yet what is worse than death? That terrifying limbo that is the borderland of hell, that state that is neither the restful sleep of death nor the perplexities of life, but is the nightmare of undeath. Where is this person? The Upton Wellsford, whose body I now inhabit, where is he? Has he, by some great effort of will, exchanged his body with mine? Is he even now awakening from that catnap sometime in the future? Awakening in my body, in my study, to resume my life? Is he doing even as I have done? What does it all mean? Maybe this is an hallucination. Perhaps I am mad. How else can all this be explained?
Special by Richard Lehman. Richard Carl Lehman, 1947 to 2001, was born in Chicago, moving to California as a child. He received a BA in English Literature from Willamette University in Oregon and an MA in English Literature from Marymount Loyola University in Los Angeles. He worked as a schoolteacher, a librarian, and a report writer for a law firm before becoming a full-time novelist and short story writer. While mainly known as a horror writer, he also wrote other fiction, notably mysteries, having stories published in Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine, the second Black Lizard anthology of crime fiction, and elsewhere. In his primary writing genre, horror, he produced about 60 short stories and 30 novels, achieving far greater success in England and Europe than in his own country. His work has received numerous awards, including 4 nominations for Bram Stoker Awards from the Horror Writers Association. For Flesh, nominated for Best Novel in 1988. Funland, nominated for Best Novel in 1990. Bad News, nominated for Best Anthology in 2000. And The Traveling Vampire Show, which won as Best Novel in 2000. In addition, Flesh was named the Best Horror Novel of the Year by Science Fiction Chronicle. He also wrote several novels under the names Richard Kelly and Carl Lehman. Special was originally published in Under the Fang, edited by Robert R. McCammon, New York, Pocket Books, 1991.
Special by Richard Lehman, read by Bob Walter. The outlaw women, wailing and shrieking, fled from the encampment, all but one who stayed to fight. She stood by the campfire, a sleek arm reaching up to pull an arrow from the quiver on her back. She stood alone as the men began to fall beneath the quick fangs of the dozen raiding vampires.
"She's mine!" Jim shouted.
None of his fellow guardians gave him argument. Maybe they wanted no part of her. They raced into the darkness of the woods to chase down the others. Jim rushed the woman. "You get her, and you get her." She looked innocent, fierce, glorious, calmly knocking the arrow. Her thick hair was golden in the firelight. Her legs gleamed beneath the short leather skirt that hung low on her hips. Her vest spread open as she drew back her bowstring, sliding away from the tawny mound of her right breast. Jim had never seen such a woman. Get her. She glanced at him. Without an instant of hesitation, she pivoted away and loosed her arrow. Jim snapped his head sideways. The shaft flew at Strang's back, hit him with a thunk. The vampire hurled the flapping body of an outlaw from his arms and whirled around, his black eyes fixing on the woman, blood spewing from his wide mouth as he bellowed,
"Mine!"
Jim lurched to a halt. Eyes narrowed, lips a tight line, the woman reached up for another arrow as Strang staggered toward her. Jim was near enough to hear breath hissing through her nostrils. He gazed at her, fascinated as she fit the arrow onto the bowstring. Her eyes were on Strang. She pulled the string back to her jaw. Her naked breast rose and fell as she panted for air. She didn't let the arrow fly. Strang took one more stumbling stride, foamy blood gushing from his mouth, arms outstretched as if to reach beyond the campfire and grab her head. Then he pitched forward. His face crushed the flaming heap of wood, sending up a flurry of sparks. His hair began to blaze. The woman met Jim's eyes. Get her, and you get her. He'd never wanted any woman so much.
Run, he whispered. Save yourself. Eat shit and die, she muttered, and released her arrow.
It whizzed past his arm. Going for her, Jim couldn't believe that she had missed. But he heard the arrow punch into someone, heard the roar of a wounded vampire, and knew that she'd found her target. For the second time, she had chosen to take down a vampire rather than protect herself from him. And she hadn't run when he'd given her the chance. What kind of woman is this? With his left hand, he knocked the bow aside. With his right, he swung at her face. His fist clubbed her cheek. Her head snapped sideways, mouth dropping open, spit spraying out. The punch spun her. The bow flew from her hand. Her legs tangled, and she went down. She pushed from the ground, got to her hands and knees, and scurried away from Jim. Let her go? He hurried after her, staring at her legs. Shadows and firelight fluttered on them. Sweat glistened. The skirt was so short it barely covered her rump and groin. You get her, and you get her. She thrust herself up. I'm gonna let her go, Jim thought. They'll kill me, and they'll probably get her anyway. But instead of making a break for the woods, she whirled around, jerked a knife from the sheath at her hip, and threw herself at Jim. The blade ripped the front of his shirt. Before she could bring it back across, he caught her wrist. He yanked her arm up high and drove a fist into her belly. Her breath exploded out. The blow picked her up. The power of it would have hurled her backward and slammed her to the ground, but Jim kept his grip on her wrist. She dangled in front of him, writhing and wheezing. Her sweaty face was twisted with agony. One side of her vest hung open. She might have had a chance. I got her. I get her. Jim cupped her warm, moist breast, felt its nipple pushing against his palm. Her fist crashed into his nose. He saw it coming, but had no time to block it. Pain exploded behind his eyes, but he kept his grip, stretched her high by the trapped arm, and punched her belly until he could no longer hold her up. Blinking tears from his eyes, sniffing up blood, he let her go. She dropped to her knees in front of him, and slumped forward, her face hitting the ground between his feet. Crouching, he pulled a pair of handcuffs from his belt. Blood splashed the back of her vest as he picked up her limp arms, pulled them behind her, and snapped the cuffs around her wrists.
"That one put up a hell of a scrap,"
Roger said. Jim, sitting on the ground beside the crumpled body of the woman, looked up at the grinning vampire. "She was pretty tough," he said. He sniffed and swallowed some more blood. "Sorry I couldn't stop her quicker." Roger patted him on the head.
"Think nothing of it. Strang was always a pain in the ass anyway, and Winthrop was such an atrocious brown-noser, I'm better off without them. I'd say, taken all around, that we've had a banner night."
Roger crouched in front of the woman, clutched the hair on top of her head, and lifted her to her knees. Her eyes were shut. By the limp way she hung there, Jim guessed she must still be unconscious.
"A looker," Roger said. "Well worth a broken nose, if you ask me."
He chuckled.
"Of course, it's not my nose, but if I were you, I'd be a pretty damn happy fellow about now."
He eased her down gently and walked off to join the other vampires. While they waited for all the guardians to return with the female prisoners, they searched the bodies of the outlaws, took whatever possessions they found interesting, and stripped the corpses. They tossed the clothing into the campfire, not one of them bothering to remove Strang from the flames. Joking and laughing quite a bit, they hacked the bodies to pieces. The banter died away as they began to suck the remaining blood from severed heads, stumps of necks and arms and legs, from various limbs and organs. Jim turned his eyes away. He looked at the woman. She was lucky to be out cold. She couldn't see the horrible carnage. She couldn't hear the grunts and sighs of pleasure, the sloppy, wet sounds, the occasional belch from the vampires relishing their feast. Nor could she hear the women who'd been captured and brought in by the other guardians. They were weeping, pleading, screaming, vomiting. When he finally looked away from her, he saw that all the guardians had returned. Each had a prisoner. Bard and Harry both had two. Most of the women looked as if they'd been beaten. Most had been stripped of their clothes. They looked to Jim like a sorry bunch. Not one stood proud and defiant. "I got the best of the lot," he thought. Roger rose to his feet, tossed a head into the fire, and rubbed the back of his hand across his mouth.
"Well, folks," he said, "how's about heading on back to the old homestead?"
Jim picked up the woman. Carrying her on his shoulder, he joined the procession through the woods. Other guardians complimented him on his catch. Some made lewd suggestions about her. A few peeked under her skirt. Several offered to trade and grumbled when Jim refused. At last they found their way to the road. They hiked up its moonlit center until they came to the bus. Biff and Steve, guardians who'd stayed behind to protect it from outlaws and vampire gangs, waved greetings from its roof. On the side of the black bus, in huge gold letters that glimmered with moonlight, was painted Roger's Rowdy Raiders. The vampires, guardians, and prisoners climbed aboard. Roger drove. An hour later, they passed through the gates of his fortified estate. The next day, Jim slept late. When he woke up, he lay in bed for a long time, thinking about the woman. Remembering her courage and beauty, the way her breast had felt in his hand, her weight and warmth and smoothness while she hung over his shoulder on the way to the bus. He hoped she was all right. She'd seemed to be unconscious during the entire trip. Of course, she might have been pretending. Jim, sitting beside her, had savored the way she looked in the darkness and felt quick rushes of excitement each time a break in the trees permitted moonlight to wash across her. The other guardians were all busy ravishing their prisoners during the bus ride. Some had poked fun at him, asked if he'd gone queer like Biff and Steve, offered to pay him for a chance to screw Sleeping Beauty. He wasn't sure why he had left her alone during the trip. In the past, he'd never hesitated to enjoy his prisoners. But this woman was different, special, proud, and strong. She deserved better than to be molested while out cold and in the presence of others. Jim would have her, soon, in privacy. She would be alert, brave, and fierce. Soon, but not today. For today, the new arrivals would be in the care of Doc and his crew. They would be deloused and showered, then examined. Those judged incapable of bearing children would go to the donor ward. Each donor had a twofold job: to give a pint of blood daily for the estate's stockroom, and to provide sexual services not only for the guardian who captured her, but also for any others so inclined once he'd finished. The other prisoners would find themselves in the specialty suite. It wasn't a suite, just a barrack-like room similar to the donor ward, but those assigned to it did receive special treatment. They weren't milked for blood. They were fed well, and each special could only be used by the guardian who had captured her. "Mine will be a special," Jim thought. "She's gotta be. She will be. She's young and strong. She'll be mine. All mine. At least till delivery day." He felt a cold, spreading heaviness. "That's a long time from now," he told himself. "Don't think about it." Moaning, he climbed out of bed. He was standing guard in the North Tower at 10 the next morning when the two-way radio squawked and Doc's voice came through the speaker.
"Harmon, you're up. Specialty suite, honors room 3. Bennington's on his way to relieve you."
Jim thumbed the speak button on his mic. "Roger," he said. Heart pounding, he waited for Bennington. He'd found out last night that his prisoner named Diane had been designated a special. He'd hoped this would be the day, but he hadn't counted on it. Doc only gave the okay if the timing was right. In Doc's opinion, it was only right during about 2 weeks of each woman's monthly cycle. Jim couldn't believe his luck. Finally, Bennington arrived. Jim climbed down from the tower and made his way across the courtyard toward the specialty suite. He had a hard time breathing. His legs felt weak and shaky. He'd been in honors rooms before, with many different outlaw women, but he'd never felt like this, excited, horribly excited, but also nervous, petrified. Honors Room 3 had a single large bed with red satin sheets. The plush carpet was red, so were the curtains that draped the barred windows and the shades of the twin lamps on either side of the bed. Jim sat down on a soft, upholstered armchair and waited, trembling. "Calm down," he told himself. "This is crazy. She's just a woman." "Yeah, sure." Hearing footfalls from the corridor, he leaped to his feet. He turned to the door, watched it open. Diane stumbled in, shoved from behind by Morgan and Donner, Doc's burly assistants. She glared at Jim.
"Key,"
Jim said. Morgan shook his head. "I wouldn't if I were you."
"I brought her in, didn't I?"
"Huh. She'll bust more than your nose, you give her half a chance." Jim held out his hand. Morgan, shrugging, tossed him the key to the shackles. Then the two men left the room. The door bumped shut, locking automatically, and he was alone with Diane. From the looks of her, she'd struggled on the way to the honors room. Her thick hair was mussed, golden wisps hanging down her face. Her blue satin robe had fallen off one shoulder. Its cloth belt was loose, allowing a narrow gap from her waist to the hem at her knees. She was naked beneath the robe. Jim slipped a finger under the belt. He pulled until its half-knot came apart. Then he spread the robe and slipped it down her arms until it was stopped by the wrist shackles. Guilt subdued his excitement when he saw the livid smudges on her belly. "I'm sorry about that," he murmured. "Do what you're going to do," she said. Though she was trying to sound tough, he heard a slight tremor in her voice. "I'll take these shackles off," he said, "but if you fight me, I'll be forced to hurt you again. I don't want to do that." "Then don't take them off." "It'll be easier on you without them."
"Easier for you?"
"Do you know why you're here?"
"It seems pretty obvious."
"It's not that obvious," Jim said, warning himself to speak with care. The room was bugged. A guardian in the security center would be eavesdropping, and Roger himself was fond of listening to the honors room tapes. "This isn't just so I can have fun and games with you. The thing is, I've got to make you pregnant." Her eyes narrowed. She caught her lower lip between her teeth. She said nothing. "What that means," Jim went on, "is that we'll be seeing each other every day, at least during your fertile times, every day until you conceive. Do you understand?"
"Why do they want me pregnant?" she asked.
"They need more humans, for guards and staff and things. As it is, there aren't enough of us." She gazed into his eyes. He couldn't tell whether or not she believed the lie. "If you don't become pregnant, they'll put you in with the donors. It's much better for you here. The donors, all the guardians can have them whenever they want."
"So, it's either you or the whole gang, huh?"
"That's right."
"Okay."
"Okay?" She nodded. Jim began taking off his clothes, excited but uncomfortably aware of the scorn in her eyes.
"You must be a terrible coward," she said.
He felt heat spread over his skin.
"You don't seem evil, so you must be a coward, to serve such beasts."
"Roger treats us very well," he said.
"If you were a man, you'd kill him and all his kind, or die trying."
"I have a good life here."
"The life of a dog."
Naked, he crouched in front of Diane. His face was inches from her tuft of golden down. Aching with a hot confusion of lust and shame, he lowered his eyes to the short length of chain stretched taut between her feet. "I'm no coward," he said, and removed the steel cuffs. As the shackles fell to the carpet, she pumped a knee into his forehead. Not a powerful blow, but enough to knock him off balance. His rump hit the floor. He caught himself with both hands, while Diane dropped backward, curling, jamming her thighs tight against her chest. Before he could get up, she somehow slipped the hand shackles and trapped robe under her buttocks and up the backs of her legs. They cleared her feet. Her hands were suddenly in front of her, cuffs and chain hidden under the draping robe. As her heels thudded the floor, Jim rushed her. She spread her legs wide, raised her knees, and stretched her arms out straight overhead. The robe was a glossy curtain molded to her face and breasts. Jim dove, slamming down on her. She grunted, clamped her legs around him. He reached for her arms. They were too quick for him. The covered chain swept past his eyes, went tight around his throat, squeezed. Choking, he found her wrists. They were crossed behind his head. He tugged at them, parted them, felt the chain loosen, forced them down until the chain pressed into Diane's throat. Her face had come uncovered, her eyes bulged, her lips peeled back. She twisted and bucked and squirmed. When he entered her, tears shimmered in her eyes. The next day, Jim let Morgan and Donna chain her to the bed frame before leaving. She didn't say a word. She didn't struggle. She lay motionless and glared at Jim as he took her. When he was done, but still buried in her tight heat, he whispered, "I'm sorry." He hoped the microphone didn't pick it up. For an instant, the look of hatred in her eyes changed to something else. Curiosity? Hope?
"What are you sorry about, Jim?"
"Sorry?"
"You apologized. What did you apologize for?"
"To who?"
"You've gone soft on her," Roger said. "Can't say I blame you. She's quite a looker. Feisty, too. But she's obviously messing you up. I'm afraid someone else will have to take over. We'll work a trade with Phil. You can do his gal, and he'll do yours. It'll be better for everyone."
"Yes, sir." Phil's gal was named Betsy. She was a brunette. She was pretty. She was stacked. She was not just compliant, but enthusiastic. She said that she'd hated being an outlaw, living in the wilds, often hungry and always afraid. This, she said, was like paradise. Jim had her once a day. Each time, he closed his eyes and made believe she was Diane. He longed for her. He dreamed about her. But she was confined to the specialty suite, available only to Phil, so he would probably never have a chance to see her again. It ate at him. He began to hope she would fail to conceive. In that case, she would eventually be sent to the donor ward. A terrible fate for someone with her spirit, but at least Jim would be able to see her, go to her, touch her, have her. And she would be spared the final horror which awaited the specials. Doc had judged her to be fertile, however, so Jim knew there was little chance of ever seeing her again. Jim was in the mess hall a week after being reassigned to Betsy, trying to eat lunch, though he had no appetite, when the alarm suddenly blared. The PA boomed, "Guardian down! Honors room one! Make it snappy, men!" Jim and six others ran from the mess hall. Sprinting across the courtyard, he took the lead. He found Donner waiting in the corridor. The man, gray and shaky, pointed at the closed door of Honors Room 1. Jim threw the door open. Instead of a bed, this room was equipped with a network of steel bars from which the special could be suspended, stretched, and spread in a variety of positions. Diane hung by her wrists from a high bar. There were no restraints on her feet. She was swinging and twisting at the ends of her chains as she kicked at Morgan. Her face wore a fierce grimace. Her hair clung to her face. Her skin, apparently oiled by Phil, gleamed and poured sweat. The shackles had cut into her wrists, and blood streamed down her arms and sides. Phil lay motionless on the floor beneath her wild, kicking body. His head was turned. Too much. She'd broken his neck? How could she? Even as Jim wondered, he saw Morgan lurch forward and grab one of her darting ankles. Diane shot her other leg high. With a cry of pain, she twisted her body and hooked her foot behind Morgan's head. The big man stumbled toward her, gasping with alarm. He lost his hold on her ankle. That leg flew up. In an instant, he was on his knees, his head trapped between her thighs. Morgan's dilemma seemed to snap the audience of guardians out of their stunned fascination. Jim joined the others in their rush to the rescue. He grabbed one leg, Bart grabbed the other. They forced her thighs apart, freeing Morgan. The man slumped on top of Phil's body, made a quick little whimpery sound, and scurried backward. "Take Phil out of here," said Rooney, the head guardian. The body was dragged from under Diane and taken from the room.
"What'll we do with her?" Jim asked.
"Let her hang," Rooney said. "We'll wait for tonight and let Roger take care of her." They released her legs and backed up quickly. She dangled, swaying back and forth, her eyes fixed on Jim. He paused in the doorway.
He knew he would never see her again. He was wrong. He saw her a month later when he relieved Biff and began his new duty of monitoring video screens in the security center. Diane was on one of the dozen small screens, alone, in the punishment room. Jim couldn't believe his eyes. He'd been certain that Roger had killed her, probably torturing her, allowing the other vampires small samples of her blood before draining her himself. Jim had seen that done once to a donor who tried to escape. Diane's crime had been much worse. She'd murdered a guardian. Instead of taking her life, however, Roger had merely sent her to the punishment room, which amounted to little more than solitary confinement. Incredible. Wonderful. Night after night, alone in the security center, Jim watched her. He watched her sleep on the concrete floor, a sheet wrapped around her naked body. He watched her sit motionless, cross-legged, gazing at the walls. He watched her squat on a metal bucket to relieve herself. Sometimes she gave herself sponge baths. Frequently, she exercised. For hours at a time she would stretch, run in place, kick and leap, do sit-ups and push-ups and handstands. Jim loved to watch her quick, graceful motions, the flow of her sleek muscles, the way her hair danced and how her breasts jiggled and swayed. He loved the sheen of sweat that made her body glisten. He could never see enough of her. Every day he waited eagerly for the hour when he could relieve Biff and be alone with Diane. When he had to go on night raids, he was miserable, but he did his duty. He rounded up outlaw women. Some became specials, and he visited them in honors rooms. But when he was with them, he always tried to pretend they were Diane. Then, one night, watching her exercise, he noticed that her belly didn't look quite flat. "No," he murmured. Throughout the winter, he watched her grow. Every night she seemed larger, her breasts swelled, and her belly became a bulging mound. He often wondered whose child she was bearing. It might be his. It might be Phil's. He worried always about delivery day. During his free time, he began making solitary treks into the woods surrounding the estate. He took his submachine gun and machete. He often came back with game, which he delivered afterward to Jones in the kitchen. The grinning chef was always delighted to receive the fresh meat. He was glad to have Jim's company while he prepared it for the Guardian's evening meal. Spring came. One morning at 6, just as Bart entered the security center to relieve Jim of his watch, Diane flinched awake, grimacing. She drew her knees up. She clutched her huge belly through the sheet.
"What gives?"
Bart asked. Jim shook his head. Bart studied the monitor.
"She's starting contractions. I better ring up Doc."
Bart made the call. Then he took over Jim's seat in front of the video screens.
"I think I'll stick around," Jim said.
Bart chuckled.
"Help yourself."
He stayed. He watched the monitor. Soon, Doc and Morgan and Donner entered the cell. They flung the sheet aside. Morgan and Donner forced Diane's legs apart. Doc inspected her. Then they lifted her onto a gurney and strapped her down. They rolled the gurney out of the cell.
"I'll pick him up in the prep room," Bart muttered. "That's what you want to see, right?"
He leered over his shoulder. Jim forced a smile.
"You got it."
Bart fingered some buttons. The deserted punishment room vanished from the screen and the prep room appeared. Doc and his assistants rolled the gurney in. He soaked a pad with chloroform and pressed it against Diane's nose and mouth until she passed out. Then the straps were unfastened. After being sprayed with water, she was rubbed with white foam. All three men went at her with razors.
"Wouldn't mind that job," Bart said.
Jim watched the razors sweep paths through the foam, cutting away not only Diane's thick golden hair, but also the fine down. The passage of the blades left her skin shiny and pink. After a while she was turned over so the rest of her body could be lathered and shaved. Then the men rinsed her and dried her with towels. They carried her from the gurney to the wheeled oak serving table. The table, a rectangle large enough to seat only six, was bordered by brass gutters for catching the runoff. At the corners of one end, Roger's end, were brass stirrups. Feeling sick, Jim watched the men lift Diane's limp body onto the table. They bent her legs. They strapped her feet into the stirrups. They slid her forward to put her within easy reach of Roger. Then they cinched a belt across her chest just beneath her breasts. They stretched her arms overhead and strapped her wrists to the table.
"That's about it for now," Bart said. "If you drop by around 7 tonight, that's about when they'll be basting her. She'll be awake then, too. That's about the time the panic really hits them. It's usually quite a sight to behold."
"I've seen," Jim muttered, and left the room. He returned to the barracks and tried to sleep. It was no use. Finally, he got up and armed himself. Steve let him out the front gate. He wandered the woods for hours. With his submachine gun, he bagged 3 squirrels. In the late afternoon, he ducked into the hiding place he'd found in a clump of bushes. He lashed together the 20 wooden spears which he'd fashioned during the past weeks. He pocketed the small pouch containing the nightcap mushrooms which he had gathered and ground to fine powder. He carried the spears to the edge of the forest. Leaving them propped against a tree, he stepped into the open. He smiled and waved his squirrels at the north tower. The gate opened, and he entered the estate. He took the squirrels to Jones in the kitchen and helped the cheerful chef prepare stew for the guardian's supper. Just after sunset, Jim went to the security center and knocked.
"Yo,"
Biff's voice.
"It's Jim. I want to see the basting."
"You're a little early," Biff said. Moments later, he opened the door. He exhaled sharply and folded over as Jim rammed a knife into his stomach. Diane was awake, sweaty and grunting, struggling against the restraints, gritting her teeth and flinching rigid each time a contraction hit her. Jim stared at the screen. Without hair and eyebrows, she looked so odd, freakish. Even her figure, misshapen by the distended belly and swollen breasts, seemed alien. But her eyes were pure Diane. In spite of her pain and terror, they were proud, unyielding. Doc entered the prep room, examined her for a few moments, then went away. Jim checked the other screens. In the donor ward, the women had been locked down for the guardian's evening mealtime. Some slept. Others chatted with friends in neighboring beds. Jim made a quick count. In the specialty suite, Morgan and Donna were just returning a woman from an honors room. They led her to one of the 10 empty beds, shoved her down on it, and shackled her feet to the metal frame. Jim counted heads. 32 donors. Only 16 specials. Generally, however, the donors were older women who'd been weakened by the daily loss of blood and by regular mistreatment at the hands of the guardians. The specials were fewer in number, but younger and stronger. Though some appeared to be in the late stages of their pregnancies, most were not very far along, and many of the newer ones had probably not even conceived yet. It'll be the specials, Jim decided. He watched Morgan and Donner leave the suite. In the mess hall, guardians began to eat their stew. In the floodlit courtyard, Stephen and Bennington climbed stairs to the north and west towers, carrying pots of dinner to the men on watch duty. When they finished there, they should be heading for the other 2 towers. Morgan and Donner entered the mess hall. They sat down, and Jones brought them pots of stew. Doc entered the prep room. He set a bowl of shimmering red fluid onto the table beside Diane's hip. He dipped in a brush. He began to paint her body. The blood coated her like paint. In the mess hall, Baxter groaned and staggered away from the table, clutching his belly. In the banquet room there was no camera, but Jim knew that Roger and his pals would be there, waiting and eager. The absence of the usual table would have already tipped them off that tonight would be special. Even now, Roger was probably picking five to sit with him at the serving table. The unfortunate four would only get to watch and dine on their usual fare of donor blood. In the mess hall, guardians were stumbling about, falling down, rolling on the floor. In the prep room, Doc set aside the brush and bowl. He rolled the serving table toward the door. Diane shook her crimson hairless head from side to side and writhed against the restraints. Jim rushed out of the security center. "All hell's broken loose," he shouted as he raced up the stairs to the north tower. "Don't touch your food. Jones poisoned it."
"Oh, shit,"
Harris blurted and spat out a mouthful. "Did you swallow any?" Jim asked, rushing toward him.
"Not much, but..."
Jim jerked the knife from the back of his belt and slashed Harris's throat. He punched a button on the control panel. By the time he reached the front gate, it was open. He ran out, dashed across the clear area beyond the wall, and grabbed the bundle of spears. The gate remained open for him. Apparently, the poison had taken care of the guardian on the west tower. Rushing across the courtyard, he saw two guardians squirming on the ground. At the outer door of the specialty suite, Jim snatched the master key off its nail. He threw the door open and rushed in. "All right, ladies, listen up. We're going to kill some vampires." Blasts pounding his ears, Jim blew apart the lock. He threw his gun aside, kicked the door, and charged into the banquet room, followed by 16 naked specials, yelling and brandishing spears. For just an instant, the vampires around the serving table continued to go about their business, greedily lapping the brown dry blood from Diane's face and breasts and legs as Roger groped between her thighs. The four who watched, goblets in hand, were the first to respond. Then, roaring, they all abandoned the table and attacked, all except Roger. Roger stood where he was. He met Jim's eyes.
"You dumb fuck," he shouted. "Take care of him, guys."
The vampires tried. They all rushed Jim, but were met first by specials. Some went down with spears in their chests, while others tossed the women away or slammed them to the floor or snapped their spines or ripped out their throats. Jim rushed through the melee. He halted at the near end of the table as Roger cried out,
"Is this why you're here?"
His hands delved, came up a moment later with a tiny, gleaming infant.
"Not enough to share, I'm afraid."
Grinning, he raised the child to his mouth. With a quick nip, he severed its umbilical cord. One hand clutching the baby's feet, he raised it high and tilted back his head. His mouth opened wide. His other hand grasped the top of its head, ready to twist it off, ready to enjoy his special, rare treat.
"No!"
Diane shrieked. Jim hurled his spear. Roger's hand darted down. He caught the shaft, stopping its flight even as the wooden point touched his chest.
"Dickhead," he said. "You didn't really think."
Jim launched himself at Diane. He flew over her body, smashed down on her, slid through the wide V of her spread legs, and reached high and grabbed the spear and rammed it deep into Roger's chest. The vampire bellowed. He staggered backward, coughed. Blood exploded from his mouth, spraying Jim's face and arms. He dropped to his knees and looked up at the infant that he still held high. He lowered its head toward his wide, gushing mouth. Jim flung himself off the end of the table and landed on the spear. As its shaft snapped under his weight, bloody vomit cascaded over his head. Pushing himself up, he saw the baby dangling over Roger's mouth. The vampire snapped futilely at its head. Jim scurried forward and grabbed the child as Roger let go and slumped against the floor. Afterward, the donors were released. They helped with the burials. 11 dead specials were buried in the courtyard, their graves marked by crosses fashioned of spears. Morgan, Donner, and the guardians, who'd all succumbed to the poison, were buried beyond the south wall of the estate. The corpses of Roger and his fellow vampires were taken into the woods to a clearing where two trails crossed. The heads were severed. The torsos were buried with the spears still in place. The heads were carried a mile away to another crossing in the trail. There they were burned. The charred skulls were crushed, then buried. After a vote by the women, Doc and three guardians who'd missed the poisoned squirrels were put to death. Jones had also missed the meal, but the women seemed to like him. He was appointed chef. Jim was appointed leader. He chose Diane to be his assistant. The child was a girl. They named her Glory. She had Diane's eyes and ears that stuck out in very much the same way as Jim's. The small army lived in Roger's estate and seemed happy. Frequently, when the weather was good, a squad of well-armed volunteers would board the bus. Jim driving, they would follow roads deep into the woods. They would park the bus and wander about searching. Sometimes they found vampires and took them down with a shower of arrows. Sometimes they found bands of outlaws and welcomed these strangers into their ranks. One morning, when a commotion in the courtyard drew Jim's attention, he looked down from the north tower and saw Diane gathered around the bus with half a dozen other women. Instead of their usual leather skirts and vests, they were dressed in rags. Diane saw him watching and waved. Her hair had grown, but it was still quite short. It shone like gold in the sunlight. She looked innocent, glorious. She and her friends were painting the bus pink.
Carrion Comfort by Dan Simmons. Dan Simmons, born in 1948, was born in Peoria, Illinois, then lived in various cities and small towns in the Midwest. He received his B.A. in English from Wabash College in 1970 and his Master's in Education from Washington University in St. Louis a year later, working in elementary education for 18 years. His first published short story, The River Styx Runs Upstream, written with the assistance of Harlan Ellison, won first prize in a Rod Serling's Twilight Zone magazine competition in 1982. It was published on the same day that his daughter was born. Most of Simmons's early work was in the horror genre, beginning with his first novel, Song of Kali, 1985, which won the World Fantasy Award. After Summer of Night, 1991, he began to focus on science fiction, though Children of the Night, 1992, won the Locus Award, one of his three, in the Best Horror category. His novel Hyperion, 1989, won both the Hugo and Locus Awards. The basic structure of this, one of his most successful novels, is taken from Geoffrey Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, with a group of individuals on a pilgrimage to the planet Hyperion to seek the demon god called the Shrike, each explaining his reason for the journey. Carrion Comfort was originally published in the September-October 1983 issue of Omni magazine. It derives its title from a Gerard Manley Hopkins poem. Simmons later expanded the short story into a novel of the same title, winning the Bram Stoker Award from the Horror Writers of America in 1989.
Carrion Comfort by Dan Simmons. Read by Allison Ryan. Nina was going to take credit for the death of the beetle, John. I thought that was in very bad taste. She had her scrapbook laid out on my mahogany coffee table, newspaper clippings neatly arranged in chronological order, the bald statements of death recorded in all of her feedings. Nina Drayton's smile was radiant, but her pale blue eyes showed no hint of warmth. "We should wait for Willie," I said. "Of course, Melanie. You're right, as always. How silly of me. I know the rules." Nina stood and began walking around the room, idly touching the furnishings or exclaiming softly over a ceramic statuette or piece of needlepoint. This part of the house had once been the conservatory, but now I used it as my sewing room. Green plants still caught the morning light. The light made it a warm, cozy place in the daytime, but now that winter had come, the room was too chilly to use at night. Nor did I like the sense of darkness closing in against all those panes of glass. "I love this house," said Nina. She turned and smiled.